Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from The James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, has significantly increased their activity during the Trump administration. Organizations across Ohio have been preparing for a possible surge of ICE activity related to the Haitian community in Central Ohio and Springfield. A federal judge issued a last-minute reprieve blocking the Trump administration's attempt to end temporary protected status for thousands of Haitian immigrants in the U.S. Having their TPS status extended is welcome news for Ohio's Haitian community, but it does not take away from the worries about immigration enforcement activity. An increase in ICE activity also means the number of protests and the presence of so-called ICE watchers will likely increase too. How are protesters being organized and trained? And what advice are immigrants in Ohio being given about civil rights? The Party for Socialism and Liberation has been organizing around Ohio as ICE activity around the country has increased. And joining us now is Deja Gaston, an organizer with PSL in Columbus. Welcome, Deja.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And also with us, we have a PSL leader for Cleveland, Dallas Ekman. Welcome, Dallas.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me back.
Deja, let's start with you. So a federal judge stepped in and blocked the Trump administration from ending the TPS status for Haitians. Does this give you a sense of reprieve, or do you still worry about ICE activity in Columbus?
Yeah, the decision to stop the ending of TPS for hundreds of thousands of Haitians across the country, I think, should be viewed as a win. Because coming on the back of this ruling were massive demonstrations in Minnesota, back-to-back Fridays. Minnesota had called for a national shutdown where 100,000 people came out, and 300 cities in 46 states also supported that call and mobilized, including us right here in Central Ohio. We saw over 2,000 people who mobilized to the state house to demand that there is no business as usual. So when we see this ruling, we have to understand it as a lot of pressure that has come from below, from the hundreds of thousands of people who have continued to mobilize across the country and here across the state of Ohio to demand that ICE does not terrorize our communities. So there's a lot of relief, but also a lot of important demands from people saying that we need to continue to organize, because the ruling doesn't necessarily mean that ICE will stop operations altogether, whether it's in Springfield or across the state.
And Dallas, let's bring you in here. ICE activity has been increasing for about a year, but more so in recent months. So how long did PSL, how long ago did they begin ICE-related events and protests?
Well, I think it's important to frame, Amy, that the PSL is a national organization. We exist in every state across this country, and we've been organizing against ICE as long as we've been organizing in 20 years of our party history. We're no stranger to the struggle for immigrant rights. The party played a significant role in the Day Without Immigrants back in the late 2000s. So the fight back against ICE is not something that can just be couched under the Trump administration. It's existed as long as ICE was created, and it's important to iterate that ICE is a new institution. We existed as a country for many, many years without it, and we can do without it again. You know, that's why our call has been not simply to, as many of the Democrat pundits have put forward, to get better training, to put cameras on ICE officers, but simply to abolish them. And that call has been standard for the PSL for a long time. But to your point of the most recent year, we've been mobilizing since the inauguration of the second Trump administration in gusto across the country, because we know that these ICE operations, as we've seen, are not just contained to one area of the country. And Trump seems hellbent on pushing these operations to where he thinks he can get cheap political wins. So it's important that we brace the entire population who is furious at what ICE has done. It doesn't take legal experts to see these executions in the streets, the conditions of these ICE facilities, to be against them. And that's why so many people, millions of people across the country, are standing up. And so the PSL has been organizing alongside community organizations, alongside immigrant rights organizations, faith-based leaders, unions, as well as small businesses, most recently on the nationwide shutdown on the 30th, in order to bring everyone into this fight, because everybody has a place in it. Everybody has a place in the mass movement. There is so much rage in the country, and the PSL wants to channel that into the mass movement in the streets, which has already shown such clear wins and putting the Trump administration on the back foot.
And Deja, you mentioned the event that was held as a part of that nationwide effort on the 30th that was held at our state house here. It was a bitterly cold day, but there were, you said there were about 2,000 people who came out to the state house for that. What other informative events have you held in Columbus? Is there like weekly meetings, or is it mainly the big events like that?
Yeah. So to kind of draw back to Dallas's point, after Trump was inaugurated, Inauguration Day was held on MLK Day last year, January 19th. And we also inaugurated our Fight Back movement across the party nationally. And since then, we had regularly organized mass meetings, called demonstrations. And particularly in December, we had just opened our Columbus Liberation Center, which is right here on Southside Parsons. And a week after that, Operation Buckeye hit. And I think this is very significant for us because we had already been doing these meetings. We had been building these relationships and organizing different tangible actions that people could do with regards to Know Your Rights workshops, what to do when ICE is at your front door, different things like that. But when Operation Buckeye came in December, a lot of people were going on break, but we had immediately called a mass meeting. And we saw 600 people come out to the Liberation Center. And it was so packed that we could only fit just under 300. And there was a line out the door, out around our alleyway, because so many people were fired up and ready to do something. And I think in our context of movement in Columbus, that's quite significant. And that shows that a lot more people are having their eyes and ears to the ground. So we had this mass meeting, distributed action items, and basically immediately called an action the following day, where we held an action in Westerville, because at the time that's where we saw significant ICE operations on the north side of Columbus. And we had thousands of people who came out and then marched in Westerville. And so since then, we've had a regular cadence of doing a mass meeting coupled with a mass action, because we want to continue to build that solidarity muscle for people. Mass mobilization and meetings are not a normal thing. A lot of people are new to joining the struggle. So the fact that we've continued to build this actually really equipped us for the way that we were able to respond in solidarity with what was happening in Minnesota, because of how disgusting and brutal the ICE operations were and killing innocent people. So all of that has culminated into being able to also expand not just the call to mass action, but expand the call to basically exercise our solidarity muscles, but also our strike muscles, and shut things down, have small businesses stand in solidarity, have students do school walkouts, which we also have been coordinating with students across the state, both in Cleveland and Columbus. And today we actually have organizers going to 3 school walkouts happening at 2 p.m. in Central Ohio as well, to continue covering the fact that students are really leading the charge, and particularly high school students, which is very inspiring for a lot of older folks who've been coming out to our actions as well. So it's very much expanded to all sectors of society here in Central Ohio, but across the state, really.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how organizers are preparing and training people to be protesters. And we're talking with the Cleveland and Columbus organizers for the Party for Socialism and Liberation, Dallas Ekman from Cleveland and Deja Gaston from Columbus. Deja just mentioned, you know, things in Minnesota. And as we've seen in Minnesota, being a protester can be dangerous depending on the circumstances. Customs and Border Protection and ICE officials have said in numerous statements that they will keep separate from the protesters unless the protesters interfere with their operations. So, Dallas, what do you tell people in your groups about protesting, and how do you train them to stay safe?
It's a great question, Amy. I mean, I think Minnesota provides us such a really important example. I think the thing that has become clear to us is no matter the involvement of working people in the struggle, the Trump administration, ICE officers, CPB are fully willing to violate constitutional rights. That's not really a question here. So the safety we have to ask can't come from just like a legal ammunition, right? We can't just throw and say like, oh, our First Amendment rights protect us or Second Amendment rights protect us. It's just, it's clear that that's not the case. And in fact, you know, those constitutional rights have been thrown back in people's faces by the Trump administration, you know, justifying Alex Pretty's execution by these, you know, slave catchers simply by saying that he had a gun on him, despite the fact that, you know, it was never drawn and he had a complete legal right to hold it. So the constitutional violations are rife. And so, you know, our analysis comes from that the safety people have is in numbers. The safety we have is in the mass movement. And two Fridays in a row, we saw Minneapolis mobilize over 100,000 people into the streets. And those days, you'll note, were categorically not violent days on behalf of ICE officers within those cities. And that's exactly because the people together have a unified power. And that's something that we're trying to flex and build. And to your point, and to what Deja mentioned earlier, this is the first time many people are entering the streets. I had a conversation with a young man who said, you know, I never considered myself political. The first time I ever came out was after I saw Alex Pretty's murder came into the streets. And so for us, what we are always aiming to do is create movement spaces, whether they are the organizing meetings we have across the state or demonstrations, where all people, elderly, children, students, workers of all kinds and backgrounds, immigrants can feel safe, can feel like they are part of community. And that's why organization is so crucial. Our protests are not sort of, you know, run on the fly. They are something that we coordinate with organizational groups. We have a muscle that we have built over many years to be able to execute these demonstrations. And so for us, it's about building the safety within the streets so that people feel as if they can participate and be part of this movement, even when it's not their, you know, typical milieu. We're not just trying to mobilize, you know, what it may be derisively called like the hippie left, right? The people who are always in the streets. No, this is a very clearly been demonstrated over this past year that so many people are willing to take the streets in horrible conditions, right? You know, like you mentioned, Amy, that the most recent day of action on January 30th was some of the coldest days across the state. And it was our biggest action. So that tells us that what we are doing and the mobilization is needed because people want to be in the streets, even with these dangerous conditions. But it's our job to create an environment that is high energy, that channels it into practical work and channels the mass movement to concrete, clear demands, right? And that clear demand that we're echoing right now in this political moment is ICE out. We have no tolerance for ICE within our state. And we need to immediately expand protected status for Haitian immigrants. It's not enough for it to be temporary. We can't just leave them in legal limbo, but our demand is that they actually have true protected status within this country that can't be taken away at the whims of a judge.
And Deja, to bring you back in here, can you talk more about safety? Whenever you had, you know, those 600 people coming to your office and then you mobilized in Westerville or you have a organized protest at a particular time at the State House, do you alert like Westerville police? You alert the State House, we're coming at this time. This is what we're doing. Talk about what you tell people regarding safety.
Yeah, our most important thing is that we have safety in numbers. The reason why any of these death squads, as we like to call them from ICE, because that's exactly how they operate, is that they are acting desperately because of mass mobilization and because there are thousands to millions of people that are coming out in opposition to what Trump is doing. So the most important thing that has actually built the courage and confidence of people to continue to come out is that they're seeing masses of people around them. And there's more of us ultimately than there is of all these other types of kind of like far right militias or Proud Boys that come out. And in fact, when they come out, there's three of them and then there are thousands of us. And people don't feel the need to antagonize at all either because they understand the importance and the politics of why we're outside, why we're mass mobilizing, and what the ultimate goal is. And our goal isn't to antagonize those people. I mean, again, there's insignificant. Mm-hmm. Our goal is to show those who are in Ohio State House, those who are in our federal government, that there are masses of people that do not approve of what's going on.
And I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're just running short on time. But U.S. Senator from Ohio, John Husted, has said the same thing that some of those ICE statements have said. You know, it's OK to protest, just don't interfere. So do you tell people, you know, to keep distance? And what do you tell people about the recordings? Because everyone has their phone out and that kind of thing. Do you give advice on that?
Yeah, well, everyone has the right to record any interaction that is happening with the so-called law enforcement that is ICE or even with CPD. I think those are important rights that people have. And I think the most important thing to focus on that we want people to understand is that when we're exercising our First Amendment right or Fourth Amendment right, all these rights that are supposed to be constitutionalized, it's clear that they do not care if we're exercising that even at a distance. And so for us, we really have to continue to highlight like the contradiction that exists between what is legal versus illegal within these moments. And I think what's really important about understanding the safety here is, again, the safety in numbers and continuing to mass mobilize in the thousands to millions with groups of people. Because I think like the reason why ICE thinks that they can do these operations is because they think they can target people in a one-off operation or do it in sweeps, like in Springfield or the pending sweep, because it's a small town. They don't think anyone's going to do anything. It's in a red state. So they don't think that like there are thousands of us who disagree with what's happening. And so it's continuing to show that pressure, again, exercising that muscle, because that is effective. The reason why we have this ruling, again, is in the backdrop of the fact that hundreds of thousands of people have continued to mobilize for weeks against what has been happening. And that it is our right to exercise a protest. I think the fact that we have CPD more worried about how we are protesting, which is safely, and it's nonviolent. We want families, we want children there. I think is more telling about their priorities than what ICE is actually doing in Central Ohio.
We've been speaking about what it's like to organize and train protesters with the Party for Socialism and Liberation organizer Deja Gaston with PSL Columbus. Thank you for your time today, Deja. And and also with us, a PSL leader for Cleveland, Dallas Ekman. Dallas, thank you for joining us today on All Sides.
Thanks, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to talk with one of the organizations that's leading what is known as ICE Watch around the country. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. Within a year, there's been a 75% increase in ICE detainees. ICE has ramped up activity in many states and cities across the country. Columbus and Ohio are included in that list. Immigrants of all backgrounds and statuses are concerned and at risk of being questioned and detained. Joining us now is Jill Garvey, co-director of States at the Core, an organization that runs ICE Watch trainings in Ohio and around the country. Welcome to All Sides, Jill.
Thanks for having me.
So while researching ICE Watch, there is no specific website that comes up. There are many local social media accounts. But when you Google ICE Watch, you get a numerous amount of things, including some like watches that tell time. But can you explain the format of ICE Watch, kind of where it came from?
Sure. Well, the reason that nothing really concrete comes up for ICE Watch is because it's not a club, it's not a membership, it's not some certified training. It's a tactic that people use to take advantage of their First Amendment rights, right? In order to sort of encourage more transparency and accountability on the behalf of their government. So ICE Watch really comes from tactics that Racial justice groups, civil rights movement groups started using in the 1960s. This is sometimes has been referred to as cop watch. And it was really an effort by some of those groups to combat police abuses against Black communities. And over the years, this has been used in different cities and in sort of different ways. But in 2017, various groups started adapting some of these tactics into what we now know as Ice Watch or MIGRA Watch.
So your group is States at the Core, and it's just one organization that works with many others on Ice Watch. But can you tell me, like, what States at the Core is? Explain the mission.
Sure. So States at the Core is really an organization that supports people working locally, sometimes working at the state level, sometimes people working in municipal government, to combat any threats or activities from authoritarian movements. And so that could look like neo-Nazis planning demonstrations in a certain city or targeting a certain city. It could involve Christian nationalists doing, you know, trying to establish a whites-only community in a certain state. Essentially, we help community groups and sometimes just networks of activists, volunteers, concerned residents and citizens develop strategies for protecting local democracy.
So how does Ice Watch operate, you know, if it doesn't have an official hub or an official, like, leader? So, like, how do you find out where ICE is and how is that reported out? Can you just explain the operations a little bit?
It depends a little bit of where you live, where you're doing Ice Watch. Some cities that have faced, and some towns that have faced increased ICE or Border Patrol activity have very robust systems for communicating about ICE activity. And those I have found in sort of my experience with talking with folks around the country, those are pretty much run by smallish networks of volunteers in sort of hyper-local places. And typically they're using some sort of communications platform. We teach people to use the salute method, which is a way of gathering all the details and verifying that what you're actually seeing is ICE activity, and then to alert your local rapid response group or your neighbors, essentially, that there is ICE activity there so that more people can come and document what's happening. Most cities and towns, folks are going through some sort of Ice Watch training. It's usually very brief, and it's giving them the basics in how to document properly, how to stay safe, how to support people who are being directly targeted by ICE, and then how to really de-escalate any violence, any violent confrontations or violent activity.
You mentioned the salute training. Is that like an acronym? Does it stand for something? Or can you explain the salute method?
Yeah. Salute is essentially a mnemonic to help people remember everything that they have to gather, all the info they have to gather. So S is for size, number of agents. A is for what are their activities. L is for location. We really, like, people need to know exactly where it's happening. So, you know, giving a vague location typically doesn't help other people get on the scene. U is for uniforms. A lot of people mistake local enforcement or some other, you know, state level or municipal agency for ICE or Border Patrol. So being able to identify federal law enforcement versus local law enforcement is very important. T is just for time. Yeah, what time? What's the time and date? And then E is for equipment. This is usually what kind of vehicles are they in? Do they have chemical munitions on them? That sort of thing. This helps other people in the community understand that this is verified activity, right? When and where it's happening, so that more people can get to the scene and document.
So we had here in Columbus what was called Operation Buckeye, and there was increased ICE activity. It was kind of around the holidays, and it's decreased mm-hmm. since then. But ever since they announced Operation Buckeye, my local, like, neighborhood discussion forum on Facebook, anytime there's a SUV anywhere with tinted windows, it seems like someone is writing, like, you know, possible ice sighting, or and I just I how do you caution that every SUV that happens to have tinted windows isn't that?
We talk about this quite a bit in our training, actually, because I'm in Chicago. This is where we sort of started our ice watch training with community groups here. And it's really exhausting on an individual level, but also on a community level, to discern what is ice activity versus what is not. And vehicles make it very difficult. So in most parts of the country, if you see a SUV with tinted windows, you're not seeing ice. So we sort of tell people they have to train their brains to look for the disqualifying factors in these vehicles, right? There are some things that are real giveaways. That is a masked, vested man or agent in the front seat, right? That is typically, you're going to want to take a closer look at that. But particularly in Chicago, we have a lot of Uber drivers, Uber Black drivers, livery drivers who drive around in these Suburbans or Black SUVs. So we train people be able to determine whether this is a livery license plate or not. That'll immediately tell you whether you're seeing something more suspicious. But just take a closer look at the vehicle. If it's an older model, if it has rust on it, if it has 50, you know, bumper stickers on it, or has car seats in the back seat, you're not seeing ice.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the public forum, Ice Watch, with co-director of States at the Core, Jill Garvey. When we began planning this show, it was around the time when Ohio Governor Mike DeWine warned of possible increased ice activity after the temporary protected status of Haitians expired. But a federal judge stepped in, issued a last-minute reprieve, so the TPS status remains for now. But how does your organization mobilize when things change so quickly and so frequently? It's changing by the day. So how do you stay organized?
Well, we actually don't mobilize. We find that communities are mobilizing themselves. What we do is we adapt our training, we adapt our advice according to what people are seeing on the ground. So we've learned a lot from the Twin Cities in Minnesota. We learned a lot from Chicago. We learned a lot from Columbus and Charlotte and DC before that, and LA. So we do adapt our training pretty regularly to give people the best advice we possibly can about how to stay safe and how to do this effectively. But in my experience, actually, people, sort of average people, average residents in cities and towns all over the country are the ones who are mobilizing. They're reaching out to us and saying, we need more training or we need more support with this. This activity, this engagement in Ice Watch, and I think maybe a broader engagement in wanting to better understand and hold accountable ICE in various places, is very organic. So we see people all over the country who are getting engaged, who frankly haven't done any real protest or political activity before.
From what I've seen, Ice Watch volunteers mainly keep themselves anonymous and are worried for their safety, especially following the shootings of Renee Good and Alex Preddy. Have members of your organizations felt at risk? Do you feel like people who are volunteering for Ice Watch and gone through the training, do they feel a risk?
I think there's a few things that people feel nervous about or fearful of. One is certainly physical safety. We've seen the aggression of ICE and Border Patrol agents increase significantly as the months have gone on. So there's real risk, I think, to engaging in this. Overwhelmingly, though, most people experience higher stress levels when they're documenting ICE, but they're not necessarily in physical danger. The second thing I think people are really worried about, at least what they communicate to us, is surveillance. They are worried that they are, you know, staying within the bounds of peaceful protests. They are exercising their First Amendment rights. They're doing everything right. And yet they know they're being surveilled while they're doing this by DHS. And that makes them nervous. And I think we've seen this crackdown on journalists and activists in Minneapolis. And so, we do tell people you should try to protect your identity and you should pr try to protect your data and your communications, because we don't actually know what all DHS is doing with the data they're collecting on people.
You've mentioned a few times the training that you offer. So is this something where people can go to your website and they can learn more about, that salute method and how to be a part of Ice Watch?
We post everything on our Substack. We have national trainings pretty much weekly. They're open to anyone. We typically have thousands of people joining each training. I will say lots of other people are training on this front, and the training is very good, I have found, locally. So if folks can find ways to engage in their community and do this training with a local group or organization, that is ideal. Right? Getting together and doing this training with your community members is really great, but our Substack is statesatthecore.substack.com, and everyone is welcome.
Do you offer training more of like Ice Watch and reporting where ICE is from afar? Or do you offer any training for people who are going to be attending protests? They're going to get out of their cars and be on the streets, maybe with their phones videotaping things. Do you offer training for that more involved approach?
We try to offer as comprehensive a training as possible because we find people are encountering various sort of scenarios and conditions. Some people are spontaneously encountering ICE activity. We always train people to maintain a safe distance, not to interfere. This is fundamentally a nonviolent tactic. So maintaining a safe distance is really important. We also, though, prep people for the scenarios where a federal enforcement agent is advancing on them. So, potentially, an agent walking towards them, even as they are backing away, right? Because we have seen time and again that federal agents will do quite a bit to prevent people from filming them or observing what they're doing. We also sort of prep people what to do if ICE agents approach their vehicles. It's the middle of winter. Lots of people are in their cars. They're seeing ICE activity. They're pulling over. They're recording what they're seeing, but they're in their vehicles. And so we do see many instances where ICE agents approach people in vehicles, and we want people to be prepared for what to do in those situations.
And do you offer your trainings in different languages? I'm assuming that you have people who, or even people who are immigrants themselves who are involved too.
Yeah, so we do sometimes. Not every training is translated, but we have done trainings in Somali because we found Somali community members particularly wanted the training or asking for the training. We've translated do Spanish interpretation. Probably the most interesting one is the deaf and hard of hearing community has come to us multiple times and asked for accessible training. So we frequently do interpret our trainings into ASL.
We have been talking about how the group labeled as Ice Watch operates and is trained with Jill Garvey, co-director of States at the Core, an organization that runs Ice Watch trainings in Ohio and around the country. Thank you so much for your time today, Jill.
Thanks so much for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk with an Ohio State professor about immigration law. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
OSU YouTube channel and experience the stories that shaped this land.
Join us for the next hour of All Sides, phone bans in schools. Do they work and how do you enforce it? That's during Tech Tuesday at 11 on 89.7 NPR News.
Hi, I'm Scott Horsley from NPR. If you've been thinking about selling that old car you don't use anymore, why not skip the hassle of selling and donate it to this radio station? It could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thanks.
To donate a vehicle, go to wosu.org/cars.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, has significantly increased their activity during the Trump administration. Organizations across Ohio have been preparing for a possible surge of ICE-related activity in the Haitian community in Central Ohio and Springfield. A federal judge issued a last-minute reprieve blocking the Trump administration's attempt to end temporary protected status for thousands of Haitian immigrants in the U.S. Having their TPS status extended is welcome news for many Haitians, but it does not take away worries about immigration enforcement activity. What are the rights of those being detained, and what are the effects of the anti-immigrant agenda of the federal government? Joining us now is Ohio State Law Professor Cesar Wautamuk Garcia Hernandez, who specializes in the intersection of criminal and immigration law. Welcome to All Sides, Cesar.
My pleasure, Amy.
So let's talk about the most recent news first, the federal judge blocking the Trump administration's attempt to end TPS status for people from Haiti. So TPS status allowed about 350,000 Haitians to legally live and work in the U.S. That includes about 30,000 in Columbus, about 15,000 in Springfield. Do you think they can feel comfortable going to work and living their lives now after this judge's ruling?
Well, certainly the judge's ruling issued yesterday pauses the Trump administration's attempt to eliminate their legal permission to live in the United States and to work in the United States. But it's not the final decision. In fact, the lawsuit will continue to bounce in front of this judge first, and then we can expect an appeal if the Trump administration loses.
So the judge's ruling postpones the cancellation of the TPS status, but this has happened before. It's been extended. The date's been extended at least twice now. Do you think there'll ever be an end result for Haitians in Ohio when it's TPS because it has the word temporary in it?
The Trump administration has been very clear that it is trying to rescind TPS, not only for Haitians, but for citizens of many other countries from throughout the hemisphere and other parts of the world as well. And so I don't think there's anyone who has TPS or whose loved ones have TPS who should rest comfortably while the Trump administration is trying to roll back TPS grants, some of which have been issued by the first Trump administration, and of course by many other presidential administrations as well. So this is an important pause. It gives folks, Haitians, and a temporary breath of fresh air that they can continue living the lives that they have been, as they have been for many years. But certainly this is not the last word. The Trump administration is quite keen on rolling back TPS, and so we should expect to see that the legal fight continues.
In the last couple of weeks, we've seen two people, Renee Good and Alex Preddy, fatally shot. There's tons of other videos online of ICE and the way they've been questioning people. But from a legal perspective, what stands out to you about where things are in this country right now?
Yeah, from a legal perspective, one of the things that's most astonishing is the aggressiveness of the tactics that immigration agents, Border Patrol officers, and Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers are using on a routine basis. The fact of the matter is law enforcement officers in the United States at every level, federal, state, and local, have an enormous amount of discretion to use violence to carry out their daily responsibilities. Sometimes that is just sort of the violence of handcuffing somebody and pushing them into the back of a patrol car. Other times, of course, it can include firing weapons. That it is very rare for prosecutors to file criminal charges against law enforcement officers who use violent force in carrying out their duties. And a big part of that is because the law is so amenable to law enforcement officers, you know, doing what they have to do. Now, there are limits. We are very much a country governed by laws, and those laws do impose limits. There is no such thing as absolute immunity, as Vice President Vance said with regard to Renee Good's killing. No one in the United States has absolute immunity to do whatever they like when on the job. There are limits, and that's exactly what police officers are trained to gather facts about, you know, whether or not those limits have been have been stepped over, and then of course it's up to courts to decide whether in fact that is true. Do the facts actually as they played out on the ground, do they actually suggest that some police officer or some ICE officer or Border Patrol officer stepped over the limits that the Constitution and the other federal laws allow and state laws allow them to move within as they're going around trying to enforce immigration laws.
One of the main differences is ICE enforcement. Currently, they're not, you know, even though they say that they're targeting criminals, they're not necessarily arresting people who have a criminal history or a criminal background. They've detained and questioned people who have a student visa or a work visa. Is that technically legal if someone has these documents? Can they be detained by ICE?
If somebody is legally in the United States, then they're supposed to be able to live their lives as long as they're abiding by whatever the terms are on that visa that they've been granted. Now, if an immigration officer has reason to believe that somebody is in the United States in violation of immigration law, maybe that's because they don't have a visa, maybe that's because the officer believes that they do, but they're violating the terms of that visa, and they can detain that individual, but they're supposed to first make sure that they have approval. The Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution does quite clearly interject what the Supreme Court has referred to as a neutral and detached magistrate, that is a third party, a judge, who's supposed to gather the evidence that law enforcement officers or review the evidence that law enforcement officers have gathered to make sure that there is enough suspicion that this is a person who has violated the law to justify what is the severe decision by government officials to detain somebody, to lock them up, whether that's for a few hours or a few days or longer. The deprivation of liberty that is sort of the core component of being detained is something that we in the United States have taken very seriously since before the days of in which the country separated from the English crown. In fact, that was one of the main motivating forces. And so the fact of the matter is that ICE and Border Patrol very, very, very rarely go before a judge to request a warrant authorizing a search or authorizing arrest of somebody. And that's where they're starting to get into problems where folks who have been with legal problems, where folks who have been detained, say on the side of the road somewhere, are challenging the fact of that they were detained perhaps unconstitutionally. And I think as the months go by, we'll start seeing more of those lawsuits bouncing through the court system.
Now, if the judge would not have done the reprieve, and if the temporary protective status of Haitians in the United States would have expired, would they immediately all be considered illegal if that TPS had expired? Does that immediately make it that they can't be here? I'm not sure, like, legally.
Yeah, unless they have some other basis for living in the United States. And this is one of the things that immigration lawyers learn quite often when they have a sit down private conversation with an immigrant. It's that, you know, sometimes a particular person, you know, has their focus on one option because that's what other people in their family or in their community have benefited from. But in that personal individualized conversation, immigration lawyers often realize, oh, actually your circumstances are a little bit different. And maybe there's some other legal basis through which you might be able to live in the United States. Now, if that's not the case, then yes, you know, once right now, the 350,000 people who have TPS are living and working in the United States courtesy of that federal law enacted by Congress that specifically to help people for humanitarian reasons and to allow them to sustain themselves while they're living in the United States. And so if the judge were to allow the Department of Homeland Security to rescind the TPS designation for Haiti, and those individuals, yes, would sooner or later lose the legal permission that they have to live in the United States. And at that point, they would be very susceptible to being detained because, of course, the government knows exactly where they live, where they work, that's information contained on their applications. Mm-hmm.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about recent ICE activity in Columbus, and we're talking about the TPS status of the Haitian community with OSU law professor Cesar Wautemuc Garcia Hernandez, who specializes in the intersection of criminal and immigration law. The federal government has also been canceling many people's court appearances, people who were trying to go through the immigration process in a lawful way, had appointments. So are we missing something here? Are there reasons that we're halting these the process to do it legally?
Yeah, the basic idea is that the government has to allow for the immigration court process to unfold. And so when somebody requests asylum, that immigration court process is complicated. It's also time consuming. It can go on for literally years because there's an enormous backlog of cases within the immigration court system. There simply aren't enough immigration judges for the amount of work. We've seen the number of judges actually get smaller since President Trump returned to the White House, and the number of cases is going continues to go up. And so the Trump administration has decided that they will request that immigration judges just close those cases, dismiss the government's attempt to deport somebody through the immigration court system. And at the same time, or within a few minutes, there'll be an ICE officer out in a hallway or outside of the court building waiting for that individual to detain them and put them into a fast-track deportation process. It's a way of circumventing the immigration court system. Yeah, the reality is, of course, yes, when somebody comes into the United States without the federal government's permission, that is a violation of immigration law. Now, another section of immigration law says you can actually apply for asylum. And so those are people. And in fact, in order to apply for asylum, you have to be physically present in the United States. That's the law that Congress set out. Mm-hmm. And the law that Congress enacted also says it doesn't matter how you got here, and it doesn't matter what your immigration status is. And of course, this makes sense because if you're genuinely fleeing for your life, and you don't always have time to wait for a passport, and the government that you're fleeing from may not give you a passport to begin with. So Congress did enact this law many decades ago, allowing for individuals to apply for asylum. What the Trump administration is trying to do is to end those asylum processes in the immigration courts so that they can quickly swoop in, detain those individuals, and try to pressure them into accepting a deportation or getting them out of the country forcibly as quickly as possible.
And do you know if there's certain people who have certain types of documentation who are more at risk of being detained than others? You know, there's the F1, there's an H1B. We've talked about TPS status, and you just mentioned asylum cases. You can also have a green card. You could have a permanent residency card. Is one more likely to get you detained than the other?
No, look, these are all legal permissions to various forms of legal permission to live in the United States. So in theory, legally, these should all be an immunity against being detained and being put into deportation proceedings. We've seen the Trump administration go after all of these at one moment or another over the last year, sort of a flavor of the month style. Or last spring, they were going after students, for example, university students, many of whom have F1 visas. Including students at Ohio State, right, who were being targeted. The government was threatening to take those visas away from them, sometimes in the middle of a semester, and yanking them not only from their classrooms. I mean, some of these were graduate students who were teaching classes, not just attending classes, out of laboratories and other work. They've gone after TPS at various moments. And then, of course, we're seeing on the streets of communities like Minneapolis and Chicago and L.A., more of an indiscriminate approach. You know, they're doing these patrols through neighborhoods, and plucking people out of their work vehicles or off of the sidewalk, or out of the stores where they're working. What guides they're using are a mystery, because we're getting very little information from the Department of Homeland Security about exactly how they're instructing their immigration officers to go out into the communities.
We have less than a minute left, but just in that short time, if someone asked you, as a professor who studies these things, should I carry around my documentation with me? Should I carry my birth certificate, my passport? What would you recommend?
I think the first off, U.S. citizens have no legal obligation to do that. We don't have a legal obligation to prove our citizenship on a daily basis to any government official. That's not the case for immigrants who do have an obligation to carry around the proof of their citizenship status. To get a little bit more information about, you know, some of these basic rights as you're learning about the community, Ohio State Center for Ethnic Studies is running a Know Your Rights session tomorrow, Wednesday, February 4th at 5 p.m. It'll be entirely on Zoom, and you can get the information from the website ethnicstudies.osu.edu. So I'd invite people to show up there. Spanish translation will be available.
Okay, great. And we have been talking about recent ICE activity and the temporary protected status of Haitians in Columbus and beyond with Ohio State law professor Cesar Huautama Garcia Hernandez, who specializes in the intersection of criminal and immigration law. Thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurovich. Thanks for joining us today.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.